He was down in the bottom of a 15-foot prospect trench that had been dug across the grain of the country rock. It was oppressively hot in the confines of the trench, and Johnny was stripped to a skimpy pair of khaki shorts, his sun-browned muscles oily with sweat. But he worked steadily at his sampling. He was establishing the contours and profile of an ancient marine terrace that the ages had buried beneath the sand. It was here on the bedrock that he expected to find the thin layer of diamond-bearing gravel. He heard the jeep pull up at ground level above him and the crunch of footsteps. Johnny straightened up and held his aching back muscles. The old man stood at the edge of the trench and looked down at him. He held a folded newspaper in his hand. This was the first time Johnny had seen him at close range in all the years, and he was shocked at the change. The mass of bushy hair was so white, and his features were folded and creased like those of a mastiff, leaving the big hooked nose standing like a hillock from his face. But there was no wasting or deterioration in his body, and his eyes were still that chilling, enigmatic blue. He dropped the newspaper into the trench, and Johnny caught it, still staring up at the old man. "Read it," said the old man. The paper was folded to the sports page, and the headline was thick and bold. "Jachont in, Van der Bael out." The shock was as delicious as the plunge into a mountain stream. He was in. He would carry the gold and green, and wear the leaping springbok on his blazer pocket. He looked up, proud and happy, standing bareheaded in the sun, waiting for the old man to speak. "Make up your mind," said the old man softly. "Do you want to play ball or work for Van der Bael Diamonds? You can't do both." And he walked back to the jeep and drove away. Johnny cabled his withdrawal from the team to the doctor personally. The storm of outraged protest and abuse in the national press, and the hundreds of viperous letters Johnny received accusing him of cowardice and treachery, and worse, made him thankful for the sanctuary of the desert. Neither Johnny nor Benedict had ever played the game again. Thinking about it, even at this remove of time, Johnny felt the sting of disappointment. He had wanted that green and gold badge of honour so very deeply. Brusquely he pulled the Jaguar off the road and scanned the street map of London, and found Stark Street tucked away off the King's Road. He drove on, remembering how it had been after the old man had taken it from him. The agony of mind had been scarcely endurable. His companions in the desert were Ovambo tribesmen from the north, and a few of those taciturn white men that the desert produces, as hardy and uncompromising as her vegetation or her mountain ranges. The deserts of the Namib and the Kalahari are amongst the loneliest places on earth, and the desert nights are long. Not even the day's unremitting physical labour could tire Johnny sufficiently to drug his dreams of a lovely girl in a short white skirt and high boots, or an old white-headed man with a face like a granite cliff. Out of those long days and longer nights came solid achievements to stand like milestones marking the road of his career. He brought in a new diamond field, small but rich, in country which no one else had believed would yield diamonds. He pegged a uranium lode, which Van der Bael Diamonds sold for 2.5 million. And there were other fruits from his efforts, as valuable if not as spectacular. At 25, Johnny Lance's name was whispered in the closed and forbidding halls of the diamond industry as one of the bright young comers. There were approaches. A junior partnership in a firm of consulting geologists, field manager for one of the struggling little companies working marginal ground in the murderer's Karoo. Johnny turned them down. They were good offers, but he stayed on with the old man. Then the big company noticed him. A century ago, the first payable pipe of blue ground in southern Africa was discovered on a hard scrabble farm owned by a Boer named De Beer. Old De Beer sold his farm for £6,000, never dreaming that a treasure worth £300 million lay beneath the bleak, dry earth. The strike was named De Beer's New Rush, and a horde of miners, small businessmen, drifters, chancers, rogues and scoundrels moved in to purchase and work minute claims, each the size of a large room. From this pretty company of fortune soldiers, two men rose high above the others, until between them they owned most of the claims into Beer's new rush. When these two, Cecil John Rhodes and Barney Bonato, at last combined their resources, a formidable financial enterprise was born. From such humble beginnings, the company has grown to awesome respectability and dignity. Its wealth is fabled, its influence immeasurable, its income is astronomical. It controls the diamond supply to the world. It controls also mineral concessions over areas of Central and Southern Africa, which total hundreds of thousands of square miles, and its reserves of unmined precious and base minerals cannot be calculated. Small diamond companies are allowed to coexist with the giant until they reach a certain size. Then suddenly they become part of it, gobbled up as a tiger shark might swallow any of its pilot fish who become too large and daring. The big company can afford to buy the best prospects, equipment, and men. It reached out one of its myriad tentacles to draw in Johnny Lance. The price they set on him was twice his present salary and three times his future prospects. Johnny turned it down flat. Perhaps the old man did not notice. Perhaps it was mere coincidence that a week later Johnny was promoted field manager of Beach Operation. The nickname that went with the job was King Canute. Van der Byl Diamonds had 37 miles of beach concession. The tiny ribbon of shoreline, 120 feet above high water mark and 120 feet below low water mark. Inland, the concession belonged to the big company. It had purchased the land, a dozen vast ranches, simply to obtain the mineral rights. The sea concessions, territorial, up to waters 12 miles offshore, belonged to them also, granted to them by government charter 20 years before. But Van der Byl Diamonds had the Admiralty Strip, and it was King Canute's job to work it. The sea mist came smoking in like ground pearl dust off the cold waters of the Benguela Current. From out of the mist bank, the high, unhurried swells marched in towards the bright yellow sands and the tall wave-cut cliffs of Namaqualand. The swells peaked up sharply as they felt the land. Their crests trembled and turned luminous green, began to dissolve in plumes of wind-blown spray, arched over and slid down upon themselves in the roar and rumble of white water. Johnny stood on the driver's seat of the open Land Rover. He wore a sheepskin jacket against the chill of the dawn mist, but his head was bare and his dark hair fluttered nervously against his forehead in the wind. His heavy jaw was thrust forward, and his hands in the pockets of the sheepskin jacket were balled into fists. He scowled aggressively as he measured the height and push of the surf. With his crooked nose, he looked like a boxer waiting for the gong. Suddenly, with an awkward, angry movement, he jerked his left hand from his pocket and looked down at the dial of his wristwatch. 2 hours and 3 minutes to low tide. He pushed his fist back into the pocket and swiveled quickly to look at his bulldozers. There were 11 of them. Bit bright yellow D.8 caterpillars lined up along the high water mark. The operators sat goggled and tense in their high stern seats. They were all watching him anxiously. Beyond them, standing well back, were the earth loaders. They were ungainly, pregnant-looking machines with swollen bellies and heavily lugged tires that stood taller than a man. When the time came, they would rush in at 30 miles an hour, drop a steel blade beneath their bellies, and scrape up a 15-ton load of sand or gravel, race back inland and drop their load, turn and rush back for another gargantuan bite out of the earth. Johnny was steeling himself, judging the exact moment in which to hurl £250,000 worth of machinery into the Atlantic Ocean, in the hope of recovering a handful of bright pebbles. The moment came, and Johnny spent half a minute of precious time in scrutinizing his preparations before committing himself to action. "Then, go!" he shouted into his loud hailer, and windmilled his right arm in the unmistakable command to advance. "Go, go, go!" he shouted again. But his voice was lost. Even the sound of the wild surf was lost in the bull bellow of the diesels. Lowering their massive steel blades, a chorus line of steel monsters, they crawled forward. Now the golden sand curled before the scooped blades, like butter from the knife. It built up before the monstrous machines, becoming a pile and then a high wall. Thrusting, pulling back, butting, worrying, the bulldozers swept the wall of sand forward. The arms of the operators pumping the handles of the controls like mad barmen, drawing 1,000 pints of beer, the diesels roaring and muttering and roaring again. The wall of sand met the first low push of seawater up the beach and smothered it. In seeming astonishment and uncertainty, the sea pulled back, swirling and creaming before the advancing dike of sand. The bulldozers were performing a complicated but smoothly practiced ballet now, weaving and crossing, blades lifting and falling, backing and advancing, all under the supervision of the master choreographer, Johnny Lance. The Land Rover darted back and forward along the edge of the huge pit that was forming, with Johnny roaring orders and instructions through the electric loudhailer. Gradually, a sickle-shaped dike of sand was thrown out into the sea, while behind it the bulldozer blades cut down 6, 10, 15 feet through the loose yellow sand. Then suddenly they hit the oyster line, that thin layer of fossilized oyster shell that so often covers the diamond gravels of southwest Africa. Johnny saw the change in the character of his pit, saw the shell curling from the blades of the bulldozers. With half a dozen orders and hand signals, he had his dozers flatten a ramp at each end of his pit to give the earth loaders access. Then he ordered them away to hold the dike against the sea. He glanced at his watch. 1 hour 13 minutes, he muttered. We're running tight. Quickly he checked his pit. 200 yards long, 15 feet deep, the overburden of sand stripped away, the oyster line showing clean and white in the sun, the bulldozers clear of the pit bottom, fighting back the sea. Right, he grunted, let's see what we've got. He turned to face the two earth movers, waiting expectantly above the high water mark. Go in and get it, he shouted, and gave the windmill arm signal. Nose to tail, the earth loaders roared forward, swinging wide at the head of the pit, then swooping down the ramp and dashing along the bottom. They scooped up a load of shell and gravel without checking their speed and went bellowing up the far ramp, swinging again to race up and deposit their load below the cliff, but above the high water mark. Round they went and round again, chasing their tails while the bulldozers held back the sea, which was now becoming angry, sending its cohorts to skirmish along the dike, seeking a weak place to attack. Johnny glanced at his watch again. 3 minutes to low water, he spoke aloud and grinned. We're going to make it, I think. He lit a cigarette, relaxing a little now. He dropped into the driving seat and swung the Land Rover up the beach, parking it beyond the mountain of gravel that the earth loaders were building. He climbed out and took up a handful of the gravel. Oh, lovely, he whispered. Oh, sweet, sweet. It was right. All the signs were good. In the single handful he identified a small garnet and a larger lump of agate. He scooped another handful. Jasper, he gloated, and banded ironstone. All these stones were the teammates of the diamond. You found them together. The shape was right also. The stones polished round and shiny as marbles, not flattened like coins, which would mean that they had washed in only one direction. Round stones meant a wave action zone, a diamond trap. We've hit a jewel box. I'll take Lysol on that. From 37 miles of beach, Johnny had picked a 200-yard stretch and hit it right on the nose. A choice not by luck, but by careful study of the configuration of the coastline, aerial photographs of the wave patterns and bottom contours of the sea, an analysis of the beach sands, and finally, by that indefinable feel for ground that a good diamond man has. Johnny Lance was mightily delighted with himself as he climbed back into the Land Rover. The earth loaders had scraped the gravel down to bedrock. Their job was finished, and they pulled out of the pit and stood with panting exhausts beside the enormous pile of gravel they had recovered. "Bottom, boys!" roared Johnny. And the patient army of Ovambo tribesmen who had been squatting above the beach came swarming down into the pit. Their job was to sweep and clean the pit bottom, for a high proportion of the diamonds would have worked their way down through the gravel into the crevices and irregularities of the bedrock. The sea changed its mood, Furious at the brutal rape of its beaches, it came hissing and tearing at the sand dike. The tide was making now, and the bulldozers had to redouble their efforts to keep it out. In the pit, the Ovambos worked in a frenzy of activity, sparing only an occasional apprehensive glance for the wall of sand that held the Atlantic at bay. Now Johnny was tensing up again. If he pulled them out early, he would be leaving diamonds down there. If he left them in too late, he might drown machinery and men. He cut it fine, just a fraction too fine. He pulled the bottom boys out with the sea beginning to break over the dike and to seep through under it. Then he began to pull out his dozers, 10 of them out, one still coming infinitely slowly, waddling across the wide bottom of the empty pit. The sea broke through. It broke simultaneously in two places and came boiling into the pit in a waist-high wave. The bulldozer operator saw it, hesitated 1 second, then his spirit failed him, and he jumped down from his machine, abandoning it to the sea. He sprinted ahead of the wave, making for the steep nearest side of the pit. Bastard, swore Johnny, as he watched the operator scramble to safety. He could have made it. But his anger was against himself also. His decision to withdraw had been too long delayed. That was £20,000 worth of machinery he had sacrificed to the sea. He slammed the Land Rover into gear and put her to the pit. He went off the edge like a ski jump, falling 15 feet before she hit the bottom. But her fall was cushioned by the slope of sand, and she sprang forward bravely to meet the rush of seawater. It broke over the bonnet, slewing the vehicle viciously, but Johnny fought her head round and kept her going towards the stranded bulldozer. The engine of the Land Rover had been sealed and waterproofed against just such an emergency, and now she ploughed forward, throwing a sheet of water to each side. But her forward rush faltered as the green water poured over her. Now, suddenly, the entire sand dike collapsed under the white surf, and the Atlantic took control. The tall wave of green water that raced across the pit hit the Land Rover, upending her, throwing Johnny into the jubilant, frothing water, while the Land Rover rolled over on her back, pointing all four wheels to the sky in surrender. Johnny went under, but came up immediately. Half swimming, half wading, battered by the boisterous sea, he struggled on towards the yellow island of steel. The sea struck him down, and he went under again, found his feet for a moment, then had them cut from under him once more. Then suddenly he reached the bulldozer and was dragging himself up over the tracks to the driver's seat. He was coughing and vomiting seawater as he reached the controls. The bulldozer sat immovable, held down by her own 26 tons of dead weight onto the hard bedrock of the pit. Although the sea burst over her and swirled through her tracks, it could not move her. Through eyes blurred and swimming with salt water and his own tears, Johnny briefly checked the gauges on the instrument panels. She had oil pressure and engine revs, and high above his head the exhaust pipe chugged blue smoke. Johnny coughed again. Vomit and seawater shot up his throat in a scalding jet, but he pushed the throttle wide and threw in both clutch levers. Ponderously, the great machine ground forward, almost contemptuously shouldering the sea aside, her tracks solidly gripping the bedrock. Johnny looked about him quickly. The sand ramps at each end of the pit were washed away. The sides were sheer now, and behind him the sea was rushing unimpeded into the pit. A wave broke over his head, and Johnny shook the water from his hair like a spaniel and looked around with mounting desperation for an avenue of escape. With a shock of surprise, he saw the old man. He had thought him to be 400 miles away in Cape Town, but here he was on the edge of the pit. The white hair shone like a beacon. Instinctively, Johnny swung the bulldozer towards him, crawling through the turbulent waters towards him. The old man was directing two of the other bulldozers, reversing them as close as he dared to the lip of the bank of sand, while from the service truck parked below the cliff, a line of Ovambos came staggering down the beach with the heavy tractor tow chain over their shoulders. They shuffled bow-legged under the tremendous weight of the chain, sinking ankle-deep into the sand with each step. The old man roared at them, urging them on, but the words were lost in the thunder of diesel engines and the ranting of the wind and the sea. Now he turned back to Johnny. "Get her in close!" the old man yelled through cupped hands. I'll bring the end of the chain down to you. Johnny waved an acknowledgement, then grabbed at the controls as the force of the next wave pushed even the giant tractor off its line, and Johnny felt the diesel falter for the first time. The water had found its way in through the seals at last. Then he was under the high bank of yellow sand that towered 20 feet above him, and he scrambled forward over the engine bonnet to meet the old man. The old man was poised on the lip of the pit, with the end of the chain draped in a loop over both shoulders. He was stooped beneath its weight, and when he stepped forward, the sand crumpled away beneath him, and he came sliding and slipping down the steep incline, buried waist-deep, the great chain snaking after him. Judging the rush of the sea, Johnny jumped down to help him. Together, battered by the sea, they dragged the chain to the bulldozer. "Fix it onto the blade arm," grunted the old man, and they got a double turn of chain around the thick steel arm. "Shackle!" Johnny snapped at him, and while the old man untied the length of rope which secured the steel shackle round his waist, Johnny looked up at the cliff of sand that hung over them. "Christ," he said softly. The sea was attacking it, and now it was soft and trembling above them, ready to collapse and smother them. The old man passed him the huge shackle, and Johnny began with numbed hands to secure the end of the chain. He must pass the thick case-hardened pin through two links and then screw it closed. It was a Herculean task under these conditions, with the surf bursting over his head, the drag of the sea on the chain, and the cliff of sand threatening to fall on them at any moment. From 20 feet above them, Johnny's foreman was watching anxiously, ready to pass the word to the two waiting bulldozers to throw their combined weights on the chain. The thread of the pin caught. Half a dozen turns would secure it. He would have finished the job by the time the word was passed to the dozer operators. "Okay," he nodded, and gasped at the old man. "Pull!" The old man lifted his head and bellowed up the bank. "Pull!" The foreman acknowledged with a wave. "Okay." His head disappeared behind the bank as he ran back to the bulldozers. And at that moment, the surf swung the chain. A movement of a few inches, but enough to catch Johnny's left index finger between two of the links. The old man saw his face, saw him struggling to free himself. "What is it?" Then the water sucked back for a moment, and he saw what had happened. He waded forward to help. But from above them came the throaty roar of the diesels, and the chain began running away, snaking and twisting up the bank like a python. The old man reached Johnny and caught him about the shoulders to steady him. They braced themselves in horror, staring at the captive hand. The chain jerked taut, severing the finger cleanly in a bright burst of scarlet, and Johnny reeled back into the old man's arms. The great yellow bulk of the bulldozer was dragged relentlessly down on top of them, threatening to crush them both. But using the next break and push of the sea, the old man dragged Johnny clear, and they were carried sideways along the bank, tumbled helplessly by the strength of the water out of the bulldozer's path. Johnny clutched his injured hand to his chest, but it hosed a bright stream of blood that discoloured the water about them. His head went under the salt water, shot down his throat into his lungs. He felt himself drowning, the strength oozing out of him. He surfaced again and, through bleary eyes, saw the glistening wet bulldozer halfway up the sandbank. He felt the old man's arms about his chest, and he went under again, relaxing as the darkness closed over his eyes and brain. When the darkness cleared from his eyes, he was lying on the dry sand of the beach, and the first thing he saw was the old man's face above him, furrowed and pouched, his silver-white hair plastered across his forehead. "Did we get her out?" Johnny asked thickly. "Yeah," the old man answered. "We got her out." And he stood up, walked to the jeep, and drove away, leaving the foreman to tend to Johnny. Johnny grinned at the memory, and lifting his left hand off the driving wheel of the Jaguar, he licked the shiny stump of his index finger. "It was worth a finger," he murmured aloud, and still searching for road signs, he drove on slowly. He smiled again comfortably, shaking his head with amusement as he remembered his hurt and disappointment when the old man had walked away and left him lying on the beach. He had not expected the old man to fall on his shoulders, sobbing his gratitude and begging forgiveness for all the years of misery and loneliness, but he had expected something more than that. after a 200-mile round jeep journey through the desert night to the nearest hospital, where they had trimmed and bound the stump, Johnny was back at the workings the next day in time to watch the first run of gravel from the beach. In his absence, the gravel had been screened to sieve off the oversized rock and stone. Then it had been puddled through a tank of silicon mud to float off all the material with a specific gravity less than 2.5. Then, finally, what was left had been run through a ball mill, a long steel cylinder containing steel balls the size of a baseball. The cylinder revolved continually, and the steel balls crushed to powder all substance softer than 4 on Mohs hardness scale. Now there was a residue, a thousandth part of the gravel they had won from the sea. In this remainder would be the diamonds, if diamonds there were. When Johnny arrived back at the shed of galvanized iron and wood on the cliff above the beach that housed his separation plant, he was still half groggy from the anaesthetic and lack of sleep. His hand throbbed with the persistence of a lighthouse. His eyes were reddened, and a thick black stubble covered his jaws. He went to stand beside the greased table that filled half the shed. He was swaying a little on his feet as he looked around at the preparations. The massive bin at the head of the table was filled with the concentrated diamond gravels, the plates greased down, and his crew standing ready. "Let's go," Johnny nodded at his foreman, who immediately threw in the lever that set the table shaking like an old man with palsy.